I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about a fascinating idea that focuses on making our political system more responsive and less divided. It involves a co-presidency. Former Indiana State Representative and constitutional scholar David Ornlicker wrote a book, Two Presidents Are Better Than One, that explores this idea. We're going to take a deep dive into understanding how it might work. Ornlicker, a Democrat, is my guest today. To join the conversation, please call us at 866-476-3881, email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Our Facebook is No Limits WFYI. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about a fascinating subject today, the idea that maybe we could resolve some of our differences and make our government and our country less divided if we embraced a two-person, two-party executive branch. We're going to take a look at what that might look like and why we would want one. My guest is David Ornlicker. He's a former Indiana State Representative. He's a Democrat, also a constitutional law professor, wrote a book called Two Presidents Are Better Than One. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. David, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
It's good to have you. Okay, so to get the discussion started, because there are this always disappoints authors, but my guess is everyone who is listening has not read your book. So,
well, that's a good time for them to read it.
Yes, not that that in fact there probably are some, but not the entire audience. So, if you could summarize your thesis, the argument you advance in the book.
Yeah, what I say is much of the dysfunction in our political system is not in Congress, where most people think the problem is. It's really in the executive branch with the presidency. And it's because we give this immense power the presidents exercise and that the framers did not intend, and that's part of the concern. Presidents have amassed much more power than ever expected, and all that power is in the hands of one person who represents one political party. So instead of having policy made in Congress where you have people from different viewpoints, different parts of the country, you really have a diverse group of legislators who are deliberating and settling on a compromise of policy. We let presidents make policy in immigration, on the environment, and a host of issues, and they just represent the views of one side of the political aisle. So the half that's not represented right now, Democrats, previously Republicans, feels they don't have a voice in the most important policy-making office in the world. If you don't have a voice, of course that's going to promote polarization, because when the election's over, the party out of power immediately turns to how can we get the power back. And we see it happen quicker with Trump than usual, but it happens pretty quick with any president. We saw the Tea Party 8 years ago. Now we see the rallies against Trump because Democrats don't feel like they have a voice.
So how would walk me through how this co-presidency, these two presidents or co-presidents, would work together? What would be the division of responsibilities, the limits of those yeah, responsibilities and powers?
Sure. Well, the important thing is that they be equals, that they not be able to make any decision without the agreement of both. So whether it's nominating a justice to the Supreme Court, appointing a Secretary of State, issuing an executive order, whether to sign or veto a bill that comes out of Congress, they have to agree. So they're true equals, because it wouldn't work if they're not true equals. But if they are true equals, then you diffuse partisan polarization because both sides views are reflected. And as you indicated, there's a lot of other good that comes out of this. It's for good reason we say two heads are better than one. You're going to get a lot better decision-making if you have two presidents, but they would be equals. Now, on a day-to-day basis, they might divide up, you know, day-to-day managerial duties. For example, one might be more interested in education. The other might be interested in health. And so you would, and that's a virtue because you would better match professional responsibilities with presidential interests. Right now, one president can't possibly be interested in all the different issues that come to the White House. But if you have two people, then it's more likely that'll be the case. But when decisions have to be made, they both have to participate and they both have to sign off.
We're talking about the possibility that we could resolve some of our political differences in this country by having two presidents rather than one, co-presidents. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what our regular listener, Jerry, has done and email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, "The problem for me is that I have not read Professor Ortlicker's 2013 book, Two Presidents Are Better Than One. Without knowing more about its substance, I cannot even ask intelligent questions. Today's show strikes me as attempting to discuss the Constitution without having had the opportunity to read it first. And you want the author to attempt to summarize and elicit intelligent questions, comments upon such a complex subject in one lousy hour of radio? With frequent interruptions, does this problem partially explain Professor Ortlicker's inability to get elected to Congress? I know he's really smart, and I mostly like what I know about him. Does it more broadly inform our current national difficulty in having substantive discussions of public policy? I wish the two of you the best of luck. I will be listening." In some ways, Jerry, I'm going to take the liberty of sort of refocusing your question, your email here. This is a complex subject, and if we were going to try to implement something, what kinds of constitutional changes would be required? Any?
Well, it wouldn't be that complicated. In fact, in some ways, it tracks the original Constitution, because originally the top vote getter became president and the runner-up became vice president. And that was changed after there was a tie between Jefferson and Burr, and it got very complicated to resolve the tie. But it wasn't because they didn't like the – they thought it was bad to have people from different parties, as could happen. As I say, it broke down because of the tie in 1800 or 1804, whenever that was.
1800.
So it would in some ways restore the original Constitution that we would put the top two vote getters in. And what the framers recognized when they said the top two vote getters is we want to make sure that in the presidency that everybody's represented, that both sides of the aisle have a say. That's good policy when you have, because I'm a Democrat, but I recognize that Democrats don't have a monopoly on the truth. There are truths to both sides, and there are, you know, failings on both sides. And if we bring both in together, we can get the benefits of having two perspectives and weed out the bad ideas and prevent overreaching. Because that's what happens when one side has all the power; they inevitably overreach and go too far, and that's not good for the country when that happens.
We are talking about the idea of a co-presidency, and Jacob has a question that's on point. Jacob, welcome to the conversation.
My question is actually about why not just move back to the original way our founding fathers came up with, and that's actually having the president picked by the majority vote, and then the VP picked by the secondary. Why not go back to something like that? Because true 50-50 power, nobody can agree on everything. There's always going to be differences of opinion, so having a 50-50 split's very hard to do. I'll take your comments off air.
Thanks very much, Jacob.
That's an important question. You know why? And people will ask, why not have a tiebreaker? Won't they gridlock? And the answer is they won't. And I look to a number of sources, one, my own experience, and also what's called game theory, which is all about when you have people who are in a position to either work together or fight with each other, what leads them to cooperate and what leads them to what the game theorists call defect. And the prisoner, you may be familiar with the prisoner's dilemma, but there are all kinds of examples. And the key is people who are in this kind of a situation, which could become adversarial, what leads them to work together is they have to have an ongoing relationship. Can't be a one-shot deal, right? And I use the analogy, when I go buy a car, I don't like doing it because I'm worried they're going to fleece me. It's a, they're not going to see me again for 10 years, so they worry about the sale. But the guy who services my car wants me to come back. I come in every 3 months for my oil change. So he's very nice to me and cultivates our relationship. So having co-presidents, they have to deal with each other daily. They have to come back. And if they treat their partner badly, they're going to be retaliation. But the other important thing is that they have equal power. If one is the president, the other is the vice president, the person who's got this higher position will exploit it. And why should they listen? It's just like when you give the majority to one party in the House of Representatives, then they just do whatever they want because they have majority votes. So it really works. And as I say, game theory tells us this, that if they have equal power and it's an ongoing relationship. And the other example I use is Switzerland, because Switzerland does something very like this. Switzerland had their civil war, too, in the 19th century. It was on religious grounds. It wasn't as bloody as ours, but
no other civil war in human history was as bloody as ours.
Yeah, but the lesson they took from their civil war was, if you want to bridge social divides, if you want people to work together rather than fight, you have to make sure that everybody feels they have a voice in their government. Everybody is represented. So in their executive branch, they have a 7-member executive branch, and they allocate it among the parties. But they also say they have to operate by consensus. They don't do majority votes. They don't want four people in the executive branch to, you know, use their majority to dominate the minority. The 7 members representing their 4 major parties have to operate and find a common ground, and they do. And, you know, the adage I like, which I think is true, is there's 80% a common ground and 20% disagreement. In our current system, where there's this winner-take-all, whoever wins the presidency gets all the power, you know, we emphasize the 20% rather than the 80%. But when you look more closely, look, Mitt Romney had the same health care reform as a Republican that Barack Obama did as a Democrat.
So let me ask this, though, because it is the question that pops up. In the event that there is an impasse, that they cannot arrive, then presumably the default position is to do nothing. So, in effect, each president would have a veto.
That's then. Right. And you might worry, so why wouldn't one, let's say if you think we have at a position in our government where we have a conservative tilt, would the Republican just preserve the status quo? And the answer to that is, and here's why. I told you, they don't have incentives to fight because why do elected officials fight? Because they want to gain more power. Well, fighting won't gain them any more power. But the other thing that they care about is their legacy, presidents. Because once you're in the Oval Office, there's nothing else to run for. It's all about your legacy. And you're not going to leave a legacy of accomplishment unless you get things done. And the only way you're going to get things done is to work with your partner. And the legacy leads presidents to do things you wouldn't expect, like George W. Bush trying to do nation building in Iraq, or give a major federal presence in education. That's a local matter, but the Republican George W. Bush, to have a legacy for education, created No Child Left Behind and a major federal presence in regulating our K-12 education system.
Would it change the kind of candidates then that we see for
presidents? Well, that is
interesting. Because, right now I'm sure most people are thinking, oh gosh, we just can't see Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton making this work.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. As I said, game theory tells you the legacy drive. I don't care if it's Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump. Their desire to leave a legacy will get them to work together. But will you? It's an interesting question. On one hand, you could think more extremes because you don't have to worry about, is this person palatable to the general electorate? They just have to get the nomination. On the other hand, because things will be decided in the primaries rather than in November, you're going to drive independents into the primary voting pool, and that will moderate the primary voting pool. So it's unclear whether you'll get more moderate or more extreme candidates. But in the end, it won't matter because they want to leave a legacy. They want to get things done and be ranked as one of the top presidents rather than be ranked by historians as one of the worst presidents.
We are talking about what a two-person co-presidency of the United States would look like with my guest, David Orentlicker, who has written a book called Two Presidents Are Better Than One. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about what a two-person, two-party presidency, a co-presidency, would look like with David Orentlicker. He's a former state representative and a constitutional law professor, also a medical doctor, and he is the author of Two Presidents Are Better Than One. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what Kevin has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Well, I had two questions, actually. One of them is that wouldn't the idea of the original republic, and I'm talking about the Roman one, with a triumvirate, actually be the best way to go so that you would have the possibility of two against one at any one time, and therefore you would still end up with the same ending? And the second question was about if the original intention of the framers of the Constitution were interested in putting power where it actually belonged, at least according to the Federalist Papers, they would have said that there should be a representative for every 30,000 people, which was their original intention. They could make that work, of course. But if we had that now, then it would put the power where it actually does belong, in the people's house.
Thanks very much for the call and the questions, Kevin. Okay, so Kevin
had
two
questions.
Yeah.
So the Roman Republic, usually the aspect of the Roman Republic that this comes closest to is during when they had two consuls rule jointly. And the framers thought that that was a bad experience. But it turns out when you look closely, that was, when you look at the history of ancient Rome, it flourished. It reached its peak under the Republic, under this two-consul form of government. It lasted for 400 years, and it broke down not because it didn't work to have two people sharing power. It broke down because they, with all their conquests, they just assimilating the people with different cultures, it broke down in their failure to do a good job of that. And when you think what happened after they went from the Republic to the Empire and they had their series of emperors, to me that illustrates the problems with a single ruler. Think of all the despots and all the assassinations. That was a far less stable form of government for the Romans than when they had shared power in the Republic. But the second question about where power belongs, shouldn't it rest with the House? And Kevin's right. That's what the framers had in mind, that Congress would be the dominant institution and that they worried about keeping Congress contained. And so they divided the congressional power between the House and Senate and gave the president a veto power. But unfortunately, what's happened over time is Congress has transferred a lot of its authority to the executive branch. They've set up all these agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency and the Federal Communications Commission and the Consumer Product Safety Commission and on down the line, the alphabet soup of federal bureaucracies. And what's happened is the framers expected policy to be made by Congress and the president would execute, the executive branch. That's what the president would do. He wouldn't be making policy, he would be executing policy. And of course, you want a single person who's executing policy. But now that the president is making policy and making much more policy than Congress does, think about the immigration orders by by President Obama. Think about the increase in our fuel efficiency for cars that came out of the executive branch, not out of Congress. The president makes so much policy now. And the problem is it's one person from one perspective. We don't have different people with different perspectives coming together and making policy. That's what the framers wanted, and they were right. That's how policy is best made. So if we're going to have policy made in the executive branch, we need to bring in both sides of the aisle to have a voice in shaping it, and we're going to get better policy if we do that.
And I should say, a listener named Scott on Facebook has got a question similar to this about having two presidents. Is that like the Roman Empire when they had two emperors? Are we going the way of two capitals where they'd be serving in different places? I just wanted to acknowledge that we had another question out there that was explored a similar theme. I want to talk a little bit about this idea of how Congress came to cede so much power to the executive branch, because I agree with you. You know, I mean, if you look at it, Congress is supposed to be the dominant branch, and normally members of Congress can impeach and remove a president. They can impeach and remove judges and justices on the Supreme Court. Normally, in any relationship, the people who have the power to fire the others are the ones who have the dominant hand, and judges and presidents don't have the authority to remove members of Congress. How did this evolution occur to the point where, you know, the presidency did become the real focus of our form of government?
That's a good question. And it starts, you know, the main, growth of this was under FDR, and with the big expansion of the federal government. His cousin Teddy Roosevelt was probably the first to begin the growth of this imperial presidency that we have now. Part of it is, you know, to an extent, when you've got so much, the government's getting so big, Congress doesn't feel it can handle all the details, so it transfers to the president. But part of it is the framers misjudged the idea that representatives and senators would have allegiances to their institution, that they would worry about protecting the prerogatives of Congress. Legislators don't really worry so much about Congress as an institution. They worry about getting elected, their own personal interests, and they worry more about their party than they do about their institution. And that's what's happened. Instead of having checks and balances based on Congress versus the president, our checks and balances are based on our party affiliations. So when you have a Democratic president and a Republican Congress, yeah, Congress is going to try to check the president and not try to give too much power to the president. But when they're in the same party, then Congress just follows the president's lead. So given that reality that people and, you know, members of Congress care about their party affiliation, we have to reflect that and then base our government around the party polarization, not around whether you're a member of Congress or whether you're a member of the executive branch.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Chris, and if you want to join the conversation by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Chris writes, in a dual presidency, would terms overlap?
Well, that's a good question, because you might say, why not have staggered terms so there's always one experienced president coming in? The problem with that is it would allow voters to game the system. Right now, if they are elected at the same time, then you get your one vote and you either cast for the Democrat or the Republican or for a third-party candidate who will have a much better chance of winning under this kind of a system. But you get one vote. If you had staggered terms, then let's say the Republican president's term expired, it was time to run for re-election or have somebody else run, then all the Democrats could game the system and try to vote for a very moderate Republican. So you don't want people to be able to do that. So you have to have them being elected at the same time so there's no gaming by the voters, that they'll vote their true preferences.
We are talking about the possibility of a co-presidency. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Stephen has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Fascinating concept. I think probably intellectually interesting at best, though. I'm an attorney. I'm not the scholar constitutionally that your guest is, of course. But I'm not totally ignorant of these things, and of course it would require a constitutional amendment. But the idea of having the vice president be the second vote getter, it would be awesome right now, especially with Hillary having received such a predominant majority from the popular vote. You know, if Trump doesn't survive this, this term, it would make way more sense to have Hillary be the replacement if there was, a removal process, which is now the question. And the solution for Congress seating, it's so much of its legislative making authority, policy making authority, to the president, doesn't seem to me to be to have two presidents. Congress can legislate its own solution to that dilemma if it chooses to do so. And if it chooses not to, that's why we have checks and balances. I think, in other words, the bottom line is the whole idea of a dual presidency is silly. And I say that with all due respect. It's not going to happen. It's never going to happen. And it's just downright unworkable and silly. But having the vice president be the second vote getter would be a great idea. We ought to go back to that, I think. So enough of that, and I'll listen to your comments on
that. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Stephen.
All right. Yeah, Steve, there are three important points with Steve, so thank you for calling. One is it workable? And the answer is after the election of Donald Trump, if anybody thinks they can predict what could not happen in our political system, I don't see that anybody being able to say that. When I was a state representative, things that I thought for sure would pass didn't, and things that I thought never would pass did. And we don't know how people are going to feel 5 or 10 years down the line. What I do know is that if you look at Western Europe, the idea of sharing power across party lines is considered, how could you, of course you do it that way. And they find what we do is silly, putting all the power into the hands of one person who could really misuse it. The second thing that Kevin said about, how good he would feel about Hillary Clinton, and that's very important, that Democrats would feel much better if Donald Trump had to share power with Hillary Clinton. And Republicans would have felt much better last year in the previous 8 years if Barack Obama had to share power with Mitt Romney or John McCain. And we're far better off if everybody is represented and we don't deny a voice to half the public for at least 4 years and sometimes longer. The other thing is Congress should just, yes, Congress doesn't have to cede the power. Congress could take its power back. But, this is what the wisdom of Madison was. You can't rely on elected officials. As he said, people are not angels. And relying on people to do the right thing, you're going to be disappointed over and over again. And what he recognized was if you wanted people to act in a certain way, you have to structure your political system to force them to act that way. And his system, because he didn't anticipate the role that parties would play, his checks and balances don't work. And we have to come up with a new check and balance that reflects the role of parties in our system. And if we really want to have an effective check and balance on a president, we need to give them a co-president from a different party who will step up, is willing and able to step up and stop them when they don't like what the president is doing. Because we see the Republicans in Congress don't want to alienate Donald Trump supporters, and they're going to back him as long as his supporters like him.
The other point that I heard two points, really, that Stephen was making behind this. One was the idea that, okay, maybe there's a way to do this. Go back to the original model, which is the second highest vote getter assumes the vice presidency. I'm not a constitutional scholar, but I would worry in that I am a historian of sorts, that in that model you create an incentive for one party to try to remove the person who is at the top to replace. So it, which is my way, I guess, of saying is how important to your model is that the power has to be shared absolutely equally between these two?
Yeah, no, you're right, John. That's exactly right. It wouldn't work to have a president and vice president because they would have unequal power. So then there wouldn't be any incentive to cooperate. The president, why cooperate with the vice president? And two, as you say, it creates an incentive to get the president out of there. It only works if you have two presidents. They have to be true equals. They have to have their own vice presidents for succession. But if they're not true equals, as I say, in Switzerland, what we've seen in Switzerland, they're true equals. They operate by consensus, and they just don't have the kind of political polarization that we have. And it does work, but it only works. The examples where you have disparities in power, that won't work.
Yeah, and Stephen's other point was that it's just not likely to happen. I mean, right now you have to ask for it to happen. Someone would have to put forth a proposal that says we're going to cede some power in order to solve this problem.
Yeah, well, why? Yeah, could it happen? Right, because right now Republicans would have to say we're willing to share power even though we have it all. And if they would take the longer term, think about Barack Obama. If he had taken this position, as he's watching all of his initiatives be undone, all of his executive orders torn up, and everything rolled back. If we had a shared executive now, we know that the good things that he was able to accomplish and that he would have been able to accomplish with a partner would be preserved. And we wouldn't have things, you know, one party gets what it wants and then the next party, and we just go back and forth. It's really in everybody's interest in the longer term to have this. And that's why I think with more discussion, we could get there.
We're exploring the idea of a co-presidency here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Jeff has done and call us at 866-476-3881. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call.
Certainly.
Hello, Representative Orlicker. This is Jeff McDaniel, teacher. I've known you for a long time. My first thought was, like the other caller, this is silly, but the more I think about it, the more I like your idea. Could you comment on what effect think gerrymandering has had in this process of polarization as well?
Sure. Thank you for your call. It's good to hear your voice.
Thanks very much for the call, Jeff.
Yeah, gerrymandering, to be honest, it's not good, but it's an exaggerated problem. The reality is a bigger influence when you look at congressional districts is what's called residential gerrymandering. Fact is, Democrats tend to cluster in cities, and Republicans tend to spread out more. So even if you draw seats, like in Florida in 2000, if we had followed the League of Women Voters proposal, Republicans would have ended up with one less congressional seat in Florida. It wouldn't have been even though the votes were even.
Although some of that, to be fair, isn't it? Kevin, I think early caller, Kevin's point was that if we'd followed the original model that each seat in the House of Representatives was supposed to represent 30,000 voters, we'd have a much larger body of the House of Representatives, and things wouldn't be quite so weighted on the rural side.
That's true. But even if you look at the Senate, where there's no redrawing of Senate lines, the Senate is just as polarized as the House. So it's hard to – gerrymandering is bad, but it's really not – if you political scientists who have studied this – do not think that gerrymandering plays a major role in the extent of our political polarization. Because, as I say, you see it in the Senate just as much in the House.
We are talking about what a two-person, two-party presidency of the United States would look like with constitutional scholar, former state representative David Orlicker. He's a Democrat and the author of the book Two Presidents Are Better Than One. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today about what a two-person, two-party presidency would look like. We're talking with David Orlicker. He's a former state representative, a constitutional scholar, and the author of the book, Two Presidents Are Better Than One. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what Patrick has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My question is, earlier you were talking about why you thought that it was better to elect both of these supposed co-presidents at the same time as opposed to staggering terms. And my concern is more about the idea of if we do that, considering currently we have a two-party system, and it's been that way since the days of Van Buren, that would effectively render the entire election process to individual parties with their nomination process, as opposed to giving the power to the entire electorate during the general election. So I guess that was just an idea I was thinking about in the midst of this conversation. Thanks
very much for the call and the question, Patrick.
Yeah, that is a good question, because in the normal cycle, like this last one, the November election would be a formality. But what a two-person presidency opens up is for third parties. Because when you think back to when Ralph Nader ran or John Anderson in 1980, if you like the third-party candidate, what you worry about is you'll just be throwing away your vote and paving the way for the person, your least favorite choice. But if you know the two are going to get elected, so you vote for Ralph Nader, you know Gore's, even if Gore finishes second instead of first, Gore still makes it in, and maybe Nader will make it in instead of Gore. So it makes it easier to vote for third-party candidates, makes it more likely the third-party candidates will run. So you may have the same turnout just to decide which two of the three. But even if you don't have a strong third-party candidate, everybody's going to have a say. They'll have their say in the primary. So, yes, it will. Instead of having, you know, one of the sad things about our system is how few people vote in primaries. The famous Iowa caucus, the highly influential Iowa caucus, I think the high point of turnout was like 16 or 18% of registered voters in 2008 when Obama was running and when McCain was running. So you have such a small slice of the electorate having a huge influence. If the nominating processes are determinative, then that's going to drive more voters into the primary voting pool, and our nomination process will be a much more sensible process.
We've gotten an email from our regular listener, Ben, and if you want to join the conversation by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Ben writes, if we had a dual presidency, don't you suppose that both presidents would just galvanize their respective parties and further the divide between Democrats and Republicans?
Yeah.
For that matter, Donald Trump's election was precipitated by frustration over partisan politics, hence the popularity of Trump and Bernie Sanders. Both candidates built their image as outsiders, so it seems like a dual presidency would be viewed as a move to cement the Democratic Party and Republican Party, perhaps even at the expense of third parties and independent parties. If anything, the rise of a dominant independent party seems more likely.
Yeah, so a few things. How will this just aggravate partisan polarization? And the reason why I don't think it will, again, if you brought in Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, to use those two examples, the Democratic voters would feel like they have a voice in the White House, and Republican voters would feel like they have a voice. So their inclination would be to support what comes out of the White House, whatever the bipartisan initiatives that Trump and Sanders fashion will have the support, because for every voter, they can say, that's my president's initiative. And that's a reason why you won't see Congress oppose and try to block, because after all, in Congress, they'll still have their own partisan battles. But the reason why Congress acts the way it does and obstructs a president, or the half of Congress that does, is because they know that their voters, right, if you're a Republican and you had a Republican constituency, they didn't like Barack Obama, so they wanted you to oppose Barack Obama. But if Barack Obama had been serving with Mitt Romney, then Eric Cantor's or Paul Ryan's constituents would be very unhappy if Ryan or Cantor were blocking their president, Mitt Romney. So it really would go a long way to diffuse the partisan polarization. What drives the partisan conflict is the when you feel like you aren't represented, when your voice isn't being heard, of course you're going to try to undermine the current executive and try to get your person elected 4 years. And then just we get this constant cycle that gets worse and worse every 4 years. well, whether it'll enshrine the Democratic and Republican parties or open up for third parties, because you would say that the top two vote-getters, they just have to be from different parties. You wouldn't require that they be Democratic and Republican. It's the best path to getting a strong third party, because right now, as I said, a third party candidate, you have to run first. And it's reasonable for a third party candidate to aspire to run second. Very hard to run first. And so third parties get nowhere. By only having to run second, you really create the opportunities for a third party.
What I'm picking up from this, and I guess I will, the tone of a lot of the questions we're coming with here, and I'm going to try to pose one here that's outside of, say, the Pearl Harbor scenario or wherever, where you have the nation being attacked. Presumably, in that case, both presidents would say, yes, we need to respond, we need to defend the nation. I think the far more likely problematic scenario is, say, we have something like the economic meltdown of early 2009. You have a Republican co-president who says the way to solve this problem is through tax cuts and deregulation to stimulate the economy. Democratic president says, no, actually the solution is to do public works investments in infrastructure to put money into people's pockets. And those are both closely held philosophic positions of those two parties. If they can't agree, presumably the response is they do nothing.
Well, so what would happen if, you get an issue where there are important disagreements, and the answer is presidents do not want to be known as do-nothing presidents. They want to act. They want to leave a legacy. And it leads them to cross over and do things. I love the example of Mitch Daniels, who, took a lot of Democratic ideas and championed them, like expanding Medicaid and doing a cigarette tax. Those are traditional Democratic ideas. So I think there is more common ground. The differences aren't as great, and they're just accentuated because right now you have to explain why you're different and why people should vote for you rather than the other side. But when you don't have that kind of incentive, where then it's really about, both sides are going to be represented, then you can focus on the areas where there is agreement. And there really is plenty of areas of agreement. And on the economy, I think we might have gotten a better package. I think we probably would have gotten more stimulus. We might have gotten some more tax cuts too. But I think, if there really are better approaches, or take healthcare, because that's a good example. The approach to healthcare, Obamacare, was an idea that came out of the Heritage Foundation. It was the conservative alternative to Clinton care. And the Republicans abandoned it because they had to have an alternative to a Democratic proposal. If they had shared power, there would have been no need to abandon what was originally their idea. So I'm not worried about being able to find common ground because, as I say, there's far more agreement in reality than you see. I remember I would talk to some of my colleagues from the other side of the aisle and one-on-one, and you realize a lot of what they say is posturing. It's about what can motivate my electorate. And if you don't have to worry about motivating your base and getting them out to vote and drawing distinctions, then they're allowed to go on the common ground. I'll use a final example is immigration reform. If you go back a few years, it wasn't for lack of a blueprint that Democrats and Republicans could agree on. That was there. Marco Rubio is a good example. He was ready to sign on to a bipartisan immigration plan. But the politics of it is what defeated it, not the inability to come to common ground. So if you don't have the political overlay that drives the disagreement, then the common ground is not that hard to find.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the possibility of a co-presidency, Democrats and Republicans sharing the power of the executive branch. I'm using Democrats and Republicans. It could be other parties as well. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what Jack has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Jack, welcome to the program.
Hi. I have an idea that someone else that's smarter than I needs to flesh out and see if it can help solve some of the gerrymandering issues that do prevent third parties from having success, and that's instead of having geographic districts, just have people self-select their district, perhaps for a limited period of time, 5 years or two election cycles or something. And we can, if you choose to join with a huge majority, fine. That may leave a few districts of smaller population, so to speak, that might be able to elect a third party. What do you think? Does it have any merit?
Thanks very much for the call and the question.
Yeah, I think the idea, I would frame it a slightly different way, but I think the idea is kind of what is behind a proportional representation system. We have winner-take-all elections. Whoever gets the most votes gets 100% of the power. And invariably, when you have a winner-take-all election system, you drive to two parties because it's just so hard for a third party to break through and get the most votes. So the way you grow third parties is you have a proportional representation system, which is effectively what you're saying. You're saying the people, the group of 10 or 20% should be able to form their own district so they have a representative. What proportional representation systems say is you all cast your vote for your party, and we're going to assign representation based on the percentage of vote you get. So if you get 10% of the vote, you get 10% of the representation. And that's very common in Europe, and there's a lot of virtue to it. The main concern why I don't press for that is still in those systems, you have a dominant party. You have Germany's got one prime minister. And so you still have a one-party dominant person. So that's why I like Switzerland, because they share the power. The other risk of a proportional representation system is sometimes the small party can get disproportionate influence. So you got to form your coalition. So if the two dominant parties are each of 45%, the 10% party, whichever one they go with.
Because it's the leverage point.
Right, yeah. Exactly. They're the tiebreaker. So they can extract a lot of concessions. And we see that Israel is a good example where a small party can exercise disproportionate influence because it's the tie-breaking party. So that's why I'm reluctant to go that direction. But it has a lot of merit in terms of making sure we get better representation.
Got an email from a listener named Aaron. Our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Aaron writes, what would happen if one of the two co-presidents were to be impeached during their time? Who would take the position if there is no vice president?
That good question. What happens if one dies or is impeached? So they both would have vice presidents. You'd have two presidents, and they run with vice presidents for the same reason now. You have to have succession. So if one president was impeached or died, their vice president. So the example would be you would be Trump and Pence and Clinton and Kane, all four. You'd have both. And one of the virtues that my son pointed out, his son Cy, when I was writing the book, was if you did have a vice president take office, they would come into office with a presidential partner who had already had some experience. And there's always a steep learning curve. And when you come in having a presidential partner to ease the transition from the vice presidency to the presidency would be a nice benefit of the system.
Gotten another question via email from a listener named Rosemary. And again, our email is nolimits@wfyi.org. She says, I like this idea, but what happens when the popular vote and the Electoral College votes produce different winners?
Yeah, so the Electoral College doesn't work nearly as well. I mean, it works badly as it is. But when you have this kind of a system, when you start having multiple candidates and you're doing the top two, the Electoral College can give disproportionate weight to the strong regional candidate. And if you look back to 1860, where you had Douglas and Breckinridge and Lincoln, Breckinridge did much better than Douglas in the electoral vote because of his strength in the South, even though Douglas had much broader support. So either you get rid of the Electoral College or you have to assign the electoral votes proportionately. So if you split the vote 50-50 in a state, you'd have to split the electoral votes 50-50. But you're right, the Electoral College starts to break down when you get beyond just two candidates.
Have you given any thought, and we're getting close on time here, obviously, this would be a somewhat radical reformation of the executive branch. Have you given any thought to ways that we might be able to reform the legislative branch or the judicial branch? Is there a similar book in the works on either of those branches?
Yeah, so those are good questions. For the legislative branch, I would bring back in full strength the filibuster in the Senate. What the filibuster does, what my proposal is about, is making sure both sides of the aisle have a voice. And that's what the filibuster does in the Senate. It says that the majority has to listen to the minority. We don't have that in the House. The majority can run roughshod. And I say to people who don't like filibusters, just spend a few days in a legislative body where you're in the minority and you don't have a filibuster, and you'll see why filibusters are important. You've got to give the minority a voice and make the force the majority to listen to the minority. And that's what why you see partnerships across the aisles in the Senate. Orrin Hatch worked with Ted Kennedy because Orrin Hatch knew when he was in the majority, he couldn't get anything done without Ted Kennedy in the minority and vice versa. You don't see those kind of partnerships in the House because the majority doesn't have to work with the minority. So that's the first thing I do, is make sure you have filibuster, solid filibusters in both. And what I do in the judiciary is, one of the nice things about a bipartisan executive is each justice would be a joint nominee of the two presidents. So what I would say is, if we don't have two presidents from both sides, I would say the president has to agree with the Senate leader from the other party. You know, so it now would be Donald Trump has to work with Chuck Schumer and come up with joint nominees for the judiciary, so we have people who are acceptable to both sides of the aisle, and we don't get these drawn out nominations. People would be nominated and approved very quickly.
That'll have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guest, David Orentlicker, for a fascinating conversation. Also like to thank our listeners for some great questions and comments on a difficult subject. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cerzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.